Hey, my name's Emma.
Hey, my name's Maddie.
And you're listening to The Pilots Pandemic.
Got gut issues? Because Emma and I sure do. I have an issue with high sugar foods and anything with added preservatives, and Emma has a whole ass gluten intolerance. So we struggle with finding tasty treats, but thank the heavens for Abby Nola because it has been a lifesaver when we want a sweet treat fix without all the gut bombs that high gluten foods like cookies and cakes give us.
Abby Nola has a chocolate granola that is made with lupini beans, so it's gluten-free and only has 1 gram of sugar, leaving our sweet tooth satisfied and our tummies feeling perfectly fine.
You guys, you can head over to abby-foods.com or the Instagram account at abby_foods_co for your granola fix turned tasty treat fix. You'll also find all kinds of recipes to try out, so you'll never get bored with Abby Nola. Use code PILOTSPANDEMIC for 15% off your order of Abby Nola.
All right. So yeah, we are here today with our guest, Tony. Tony, thank you so much for joining us today. We actually connected over Instagram on the Pilots Pandemic page, and you shared a little bit of your story with me. And then we talked over Zoom, and I knew immediately that I had to have you on the show and that I really wanted to share your story. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah. Thanks for having me this morning.
Yeah. So we always ask our guests, like, how did your journey into aviation begin? And is there anyone who inspired you to start on this path?
Aviation, I think the earliest I can kind of recall when I was a really young kid, kindergarten or so, was super into World War II, of all things, as a kid, which might explain why I didn't have too much luck making friends at the time. But, you know, I had stuff like a lot of model airplanes, old P-51s, P-38s. I was just really interested as a kid. My parents would take me to the aerospace museums down in Texas growing up and that sort of thing. And that all kind of faded away, kind of growing up a little bit from there. Got really into music, was trying to go to school to become a music major and trying to make my way through school. And my freshman year of college was kind of a disaster. So I kind of decided that I needed to join the military to try and, one, be able to afford to go to college, move away from Texas and that sort of thing. And after a lot of talk with my dad, I ended up going to the Coast Guard recruiting office of all places. And the two jobs that stuck out to me were working as in aviation. So I ended up kind of going that way. And from there, after crewing C-130s for a number of years while I was still in the Coast Guard, I kind of just had this light bulb moment after sitting right behind the pilots on the Herc. It's like, you know, this seems like an awesome job. I figure I should probably try and pursue this. So after I finished my enlistment, I got out, moved to Utah, and used my GI Bill to go to flight school and get a bachelor's degree.
That's so cool. We haven't talked to very many people that have gone through the Coast Guard and then made it into aviation. So I always think that's really interesting route. But your journey kind of into the flight deck has not been the smoothest of sailing. And so I wanted to let our audience know that oftentimes there are events that lead up to having a mental health diagnosis. And those events that happens are very traumatic ones. And I know that you have a story to share that dives into some of those circumstances. So will you be willing to share with our audience like that traumatic experience or the traumatic event that happened to you that now has led you to be in the special issuance process?
Yeah, absolutely. Might be speaking a little bit slow to it, but I'm obviously more than happy to kind of share my experience on this. So I believe it was summer of 2015. I was straight out of Coast Guard boot camp in Hawaii, waiting to go to the technical school you have to go to get into the aviation world of the Coast Guard. And while I was out there, I was just out driving around the island, I might kind of pull the old news article up just to kind of keep me on pace. But essentially what happened on the east side of Oahu, there's this area called the Holona Blowhole, and there's a little kind of beach cove down underneath the sea cliffs that people go to. And I was there with a friend, just kind of hanging out after a day of surfing around on the North Shore. And all of a sudden from the parking lot, I just hear a lot of yelling, a lot of commotion, and kind of get out of my car and run over and kind of look to see what's going on. And there were these two guys that I guess were climbing around on the cliff walls, trying to get down to that little beach down there. I think it's called Cockroach Cove, and they're knocked into the water. It's incredibly high surf from what I recall, probably 8-foot size waves out there. And I kind of just had a reflex kind of impulse decision that I had two bodyboards in the car. And I think I kind of knew from the get-go that by the time any sort of actual first response is going to get out there, these guys are probably going to be drowned. So I just tried to scramble down in all of my 19-year-old genius and critical thinking, hop in the water. I got out there, tried swimming to these two guys as they were maybe only 50, 100 feet offshore. And I kind of got into the break zone and started getting run through the wash machine. And it was terrifying. So after, I don't know, 2-3 waves that broke on me, I kind of looked up and saw I was pushed right up against the nice solid volcanic cliffs that I had just scrambled down. And again, kind of just realized, I was like, all right, well, this next wave breaks, it's gonna smash my head like an egg. So ditched the bodyboards, and I just got lucky that the next wave didn't break and it was a swell where it kind of helped to lift me up, kind of scrambled back up out of the water, kind of rolled out on to one of the lower kind of cliff benches. And after kind of catching my breath and kind of calming down a little bit, I looked back out to the water and I saw at least one of the guys, unfortunately, head down in the water bobbing, again, not that far away, and just kind of had to come to terms that if I tried to do anything further, I'd probably be body number 3 that day. So climbed up, got back to the parking lot and pulled all the coral rocks out of my feet and hands. I got scratched up pretty good and just kind of went home and went back to work pretty much the next day and just didn't say a word about it because I was pretty embarrassed about the whole thing, and I was really hard on myself at the time as a kid.
Yeah. I can only imagine like how helpless you feel in that situation, like, and the trauma that comes after that. Like there's you did everything that you could and it still wasn't enough. I can just imagine the mental toll that takes on you. And you said you were only 19, like that I really can't imagine. My heart like goes out to you. But as I said, I can only imagine how difficult the aftermath of that event was for you, as it would be for anyone. But what happened in the months following this event as it relates to your mental health? You said you kind of didn't acknowledge it at first. It seems like maybe you tried to sweep it under the rug, but things started to boil up.
Oh yeah, that's absolutely what happened. Like there was definitely this feeling of shame of, wow, I joined a, Coast Guard's known as a life-saving service, and that sort of mentality is drilled into your head pretty hard in boot camp. And that was maybe 3 months out and you're still in this kind of robotic kind of freakazoid mentality that boot camp kind of makes you a little kooky for. And then you finally settle down a little after the fact and you start acting like a normal person again. But it kind of really stung mentally from that standpoint, where it made me feel like a bit of a failure. And again, minimized it all because I think I kind of knew pretty quickly that this was having a really hard impact on my mental health. But again, in the military, you start having any sort of issues with the quality of your mental health, you get medically discharged pretty fast. And I obviously did not want that to happen. So bottled it up as best as I could, but I was having night terrors, very vivid ones of that event, just recurring constantly, probably for a couple times a week for about a year. Definitely had a hard time making friends while I was there, was not taking care of myself at all. And that sort of, those issues started to kind of subside a bit once I got transferred from Hawaii out to North Carolina to go to tech school to actually start doing the job in aviation that I wanted to do. So that kind of physical transition out of that space where it happened helped a lot, but I still think it impacted a lot of my behavior and maybe ways that I still don't kind of fully have a grasp on that were just really negative towards myself and how I interacted with others.
Yeah, the fact that you had mentioned that you were 19, I think earlier when we talked about this, for some reason I didn't really latch on to your age when this event happened, but that is something that, like, you're so young, like, how do you deal with that, you know, seeing people die? And also, like you had said, you know, you put that on your shoulders as, like, that was your responsibility to save them. And obviously it was their time to go, but I think just like listening to that, even for me, I'm like, wow, Tony, that is really hard to as a 19-year-old, like, I can't imagine. Because I think back when I was 19, and me processing, like, one of my best friends passing away was really difficult. I guess what I wanted to ask you was, when did you realize at the time that this would affect your flying career? Or was it just kind of that culture of being in the military is why you pushed it down? And then if it was that way, like, when did you realize that maybe this was going to affect your aviation track?
Well, at the time of being 19, I mean, this is almost 10 years ago now, I didn't quite make the decision to start flying myself yet, but just being focused on, I guess, my immediate enlistment, it was, I guess, kind of culturally, there felt like a need of just like, well, sometimes bad shit happens and you just have to bottle it up, kind of, you know, put whatever band-aid you need to put on it and keep going. That's kind of at least how I thought of things then and there, and kind of moving on and getting to start doing the job that I'd wanted to do, which was search and rescue air crew. I got to do a lot of really cool things and really cool missions to where I actually got to help people. And I think finally kind of getting to settle the score, quote unquote, did a lot, I guess, maybe short term for me, where it was, well, you know, when I was a kid, I wasn't able to help these two guys, but moving on and years not too far from that, I was like, I got to help quite a few people between hurricanes, a lot of search and rescue out in the open ocean. And I think at the time it kind of, it gave me some temporary peace, I think, until I got out of the Coast Guard in 2019.
Almost like a band-aid a little bit. It's like kind of balancing the scales. I find myself doing that a lot. I feel like that's kind of a reflection of the podcast a little bit, like the pain that I feel from everything that I've lost and trying to make sure that it doesn't happen to anyone else or that people understand that they've been hurt. So I can definitely resonate with that. So you're obviously going through the special issuance process right now. That's why we are talking to you today on the show, among many other things. But I know you said this has been like just an eye-opening process. What were things that you didn't expect that you are now facing in regards to the special issuance process or the FAA's aeromedical standards?
Well, I guess to talk about the special issuance process. I guess I'm somewhat at a hold after a pretty expensive and just emotionally draining series of, well, not even months. I guess it was a little bit over a year. I guess to kind of give the show a little bit of backstory, after getting out of the Coast Guard, went to school, kind of started to have, I guess, what's unfortunately pretty traditional for folks getting out of the service, which is to kind of have that high speed work environment and not really having to think too much about yourself when you're kind of in this big team sort of thing. So I think once I left the Coast Guard there, a lot of those issues that I'd kind of bottled up had started to really bubble up, where I was feeling very depressed. And at that point, when I was enrolled in college and ready to start working on my private pilot's license, I kind of had the thought then that I was like, all right, this is, again, stuff that is going to give me a lot of trouble and is potentially going to cause me to lose my medical. So I just need to try and keep a lid on this and not think about it for as much as I can, because even then I kind of known that I was like, if I go to a therapist or if I seek counseling or antidepressants or anything like that, it's going to basically cost me a college degree and my GI Bill if I do this.
Did you have that preconceived notion from the attitude that you carried with you out of the Coast Guard, or was it rumblings within the aviation community or during your flight training that gave you that belief?
I think it was just at that point from the military kind of medical that you need, that was something that had already kind of been discussed amongst other folks that I had been working with. It's like, you know, you can't go saying that you're having, you know, problems, nightmares, whatever, about you know, whatever SAR search and rescue case that you've had going wrong, because you know, potentially get you grounded there. So I guess I was kind of already adjusted to that being something to be very cautious about in regards to flying. So I probably just did a little bit of research, I guess, when I went to go get my FAA medical and saw it was pretty much the same ordeal. So I guess I just tried to bottle things up until it all kind of came to a point down the road.
Well, that's like very natural to do. I think most of us kind of rely on bottling things up so we can get through our lives. But it is interesting because I feel like the stigma kind of was there in the military and it crossed over into aviation once you started doing a little bit of digging. And you really don't have to dig far to see the stigma in aviation. But I did want to ask you, because you mentioned like you're in a little bit of a pause right now in the special issuance process. So where are you kind of at with things?
As of right now, I am just kind of still waiting to kind of weigh my options for reapplying to get a medical after having my original medical revoked through an emergency revocation. I've talked to a few folks, Dr. Billy being one of them, who's referred me to a firm, and I've spoken to another military vet. He was a guy that was a Air Force C-130 pilot who dealt with something similar in my case, and kind of got to hear about how he eventually kind of found his way back into the flight deck. And I guess to sum it up, I'm really waiting until I see much more clear pathways and timelines and price tags to receiving a medical before I throw away any more money at trying to keep my medical or to get, I guess, a new one at this point.
Totally. I mean, that makes sense. And that's kind of what Emma and I are fighting for too. It's like, hey, you're going to pay so much money into the process, there should be like, you know, a guarantee that you're going to get your medical back. And when you just started talking about kind of like waiting on going through the process again, the story about you and your test that you did, cognitive screening, popped up in my head, and I was like, Tony, we need to talk about this. We need to unpack this because I think our audience would find this interesting. So the cog screen that you did, you had some interesting feedback from the person who gave it to you. And I wanted to, I don't know if you're like connecting the dots of what I'm talking about, but it has to do with you being a musical person, and what they kind of told you that about your cog screen and the person that you are. And you thought it was interesting because it's kind of contradictive of who you actually are. So can you kind of share that story with our audience about the cog screen and how it was for you?
Sure. So cog screen was just one of the maybe 20 to 30 different kind of neurological tests that I ended up doing. And this is a great question because I actually had pulled up the 200 page docket that I was sent from the FAA, which included this neurological testing. And of what I suppose this is the MMPI-2 Airline Pilots Interpretive Report. So of the thousands of computer questions that I had to click true false on, plus cog screen and a bunch of just really odd, bizarre tests that I did. The I guess that paragraph there about personal adjustment from the MMPI test was that let's see here. Well, one, it says that the applicant scale profile does not deviate substantially from individuals in the normative sample. Moreover, his responses indicated that he did not report any psychological conflicts or stresses that are producing great problems for him at this time. However, he seems to lack the broad cultural interests that are characteristics of many individuals with his level of education. He appears to have a rather limited range of interest and prefers traditional action-oriented activities to artistic literary pursuits or introspective experiences. Oh, I forgot this was the one that stung. He may be somewhat intolerant and insensitive, and others may view him as rather crude, coarse, or narrow-minded. So I guess to
Wow.
kind of laugh at that last part was
First, I cannot believe that they said that to you after you went to college and were pursuing a degree in music. And then for them to say that to you after, like, it feels like everything that you've chosen up to this point is really to help other people. That verbiage is just insane to me.
which I don't recall there being any questions about my, interest in the arts. I could be a huge dork and talk about a lot of art history in like Europe as far as like the 19th century postmodernist movement. But yeah, was a music major initially, used to play probably four or five different instruments very proficiently. Kind of been a home produced musician. I've got music on Spotify when I still had a passport and the time and money to go travel abroad. Would typically just immerse myself in different languages as much as I could, and so on and so forth. So yeah, seems like a bit of a blind spot in the $5,000 test that I paid to have performed. But I think, more so is the profile, or I believe it's this profile validity section that saying that I'm fine. Let's see. Yeah, manages their lives, shows resiliency, didn't report any psychological conflicts or stresses. I think that's a big part.
Yes, it
So,
is.
because that's the stuff that was submitted to the FAA and still ended up with an emergency revocation.
It's mind-blowing. And forgive me for me jumping around a little bit, but one of the things that really stood out to me in our pre-podcast conversation is that you've always really had this desire and want to try and help people. You seem kind of like a rescue-orientated person. Like you have that want to like, okay, I want to not save the day, but if I can improve someone's life in any way, I'm gonna do the best that I can to do that. I mean, right now you're doing ski patrol, and that's like another form of, kind of like first responding, like you're helping people. So for them to say that to you, and then all of that that is in your personal life, all of your hobbies, who you are as an actual human being, that's just, it's mind blowing to me. I mean, it's almost like insulting your character a little bit. When you told me that, I know Maddie and I were mind blown, but you've mentioned something about all of these tests, it costing you around $5,000. How, if you don't mind sharing, how much do you think you've spent so far in this process?
So that the initial kind of testing that I had completed in Salt Lake, that was $5,000 of my money and about 2 days of my time, because this was two full days of psychological testing. Like it felt borderline, I mean, inhumane is a bit too strong of a word, but it just was incredibly damaging, I think, to my own psyche, to kind of feel like I was being treated as just completely, as a totally incapable person of being able to handle anything in my own life or career or anything like that. And it was stressful and it was frustrating. And in talking to some of the techs that were issuing these tests, because I kind of just got round robined between two or three different test technicians, and think probably 5 or 6 hours into it, there was a younger technician. I just kind of looked at her and asked her, and I was like, this is crazy, right? Like, people don't come into this test and act like this seems perfectly reasonable, right? And I think she agreed. She's like, oh yeah, like we have very senior airline captains coming in here to do these tests too. And it's like stuff like being told a series of numbers and being asked to repeat them back to the person giving the test, and the numbers just kind of get longer and longer until to failure pretty much. So a lot of this was very like mentally taxing to kind of stress test your brain, so to speak, for all this info to be sent to the FAA.
The fact that it's all leveraged off of either you're going to get your medical back or not, like the stress of that on top of all of this is just it. Yeah, I agree. Like, inhumane is maybe a little bit too strong of a word, but it's very punitive and it's just not fair. I can't even imagine. I think Maddie and I were having a conversation. We were like, if you ever had to do these tests, like, I can't even imagine the amount of anxiety that I would have walking in those doors, knowing everything that is on the line for me. And I don't even fly for a career. It is not a profession to me. It is just a passion. It's something that I grew up with. It's something that I always want in my life, but just that in itself, that fear that builds up inside of me. And that's a hypothetical situation. I can't imagine what it's like to sit in that chair and actually do those tests. Baffling.
Yeah. Demeaning, I think, is the word that I was looking for. But yeah, from the moment you walk into the office, you just feel like you were being observed, and which you are. There were comments somewhere in my big docket about my personal appearance and in grooming and so on. Oh, but gosh, it was just,
that's so insane that they even make remarks on your appearance, because mm-hmm. people present in different ways. And so to me, I'm like, wow, because honestly, I look like a bum half of the time, and I live in the Pacific Northwest. Tony, I think you're from Washington too, right?
I live in Central Washington right okay. now. I've lived all over, but yeah, I'm just a couple hours away from you on the other side of the Cascades.
Yeah, and I'm actually from Lake Chelan area. So yeah, close by. Because I saw you were in Wenatchee, but anyways, it's just that Washington, like, it's funny because when I go to visit Emma, the East Coast, like, dresses up for things, and, like, you know, like, everyone wants to go out, you have to make a reservation. When you come to the West Side, it's not like that. Like, people go to the grocery store in their sweatpants. Like, you could see a millionaire and you wouldn't know it. Like, they're not dressed to the nines. So it is interesting that they take appearance into your your testing of like, hey, this person is cognitively functioning okay based off appearance. Like, that makes no sense to me.
It feels almost discriminatory. Like, yeah. I'm like, do they judge you if you have tattoos? Like, if you have tattoos that are showing, I'm like, also like, I don't know, that could get really deep and really nasty and ugly really quickly. And I'm honestly baffled that in the 21st century that's one of the identifiers and something that they're putting in your file, and that the FAA is looking at that as one of the yes or no's. Insane.
Yeah, I'm trying to fight it in here, but I think it was kind of primarily geared like kind of more hygienic wise. Like, I don't think it was, you know, they weren't doing a fit check or anything like that. Yeah. on me, but I do recall just there were little things that were kind of noted upon. So
what if I wear natural deodorant and I'm stinky that day?
Yeah, that happens to me all the time.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Well, okay, so we gotta get back on track, but okay. I'll let you know what, Maddie, I'm gonna let you push to 8.
Okay, but I did want to ask you, Tony, I know that like you're waiting to like maybe resubmit and right now, but I did want to ask this question because I don't think we really asked this question and it's important to know. So if like, let's say you were to get your medical back, would that restore your trust in the FAA or would you still be like, I don't trust this government body?
I think it would be a massive improvement. I know that not too long ago, I think it was in the past year, the Air Medical Office got rid of the requirement for these tests that we just talked about to be recurring. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I do recall seeing that being dropped, which I never want to spend $5,000 in 2 days of my life kind of just being run through the ringer like that again. But I would be maybe a little concerned about the possibility that if I were to end up in some sort of, you know, mishap or an investigation, that my mental health would become a focus, like something as benign as being involved with a bird strike. And, you know, they're kind of going through the list with the NTSB and, you know, that my personal history comes up. I feel like that's something that could be probably poked and prodded a bit more than the average person. But I don't know if more change in the right direction keeps coming, then I'd like to think that things are going to continue to trend in that direction, to hopefully have the FAA actually serve the responsibilities that it's charged with.
If you get your medical back, will you, and this might be a silly question, will you be on an SI or is it just they're going to reverse it? Or are you trying to get it just reversed so that you'll be on just a straight, or say like for an example, you'd be on a normal third class medical, you wouldn't have to go in every single year and like reapply?
I think I'm at that point to where that would be a discussion that I need to have with whatever kind of legal and medical team I consult, or AME if I can find one that's willing to deal with the headache, because all of that testing and the attorney fees that I had involved with, those tests were kind of retroactively applied to my formerly current medical, which didn't have an SI or anything because I hadn't needed to, you know, work with a crisis hotline or anything like that and go to therapy. So I think that would, you know, I'd kind of just be starting from square one and just trying to get bearings along with an AME to see what would potentially be the easiest way to work it through. The Air Force vet that I talked about, who also had his medical pulled for depression and having assistance from the VA, if I can recall, we spoke on LinkedIn about a week ago, sounded like the AME that he was working with just kind of kept having the back and forth with the FAA over and over, just to kind of, I guess, stand their ground for not pulling this gentleman's medical, and let's see, I'm kind of pulling up his messages right now just to scroll through it. But let's see, yeah, the way it was described was that the very harassing letters to the treating physician. So I guess this person's AME kind of also acted in that role. And you know, I guess it just kind of came down to they just kind of keep poking and prodding for status reports until they, you know, just kind of grant you the medical because, and again, I'm kind of lightly paraphrasing from this person. Yeah. There was never anything that warranted them to revoke it in the first place. So again, there's just all of this kind of peripheral kind of hearsay and personal anecdotes about getting the medical back to where it just feels difficult to really see a clear kind of checklist to get through.
Transparency.
Yeah.
That lack of transparency. Okay. I have to ask you one more question. It's not scripted. It'll be the last unscripted question I ask you. Actually, never mind. I can't promise that. If you get your medical back and you are on a special issuance, will you feel satisfied, or is that going to kind of bug you a little bit?
I mean, if it's a SI that is issued without any, you know, restrictions to working commercially, because I, you know, commercial pilot with a CFI, and the whole point of me getting into aviation in the first place was to work, I think I would call it, you know, good enough and try and get that career started again.
For sure.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's what we hope that happens for you, Tony, is that you do get your medical back and you do the career that you love, and it's all good. But I mean, you just touching on, like, you don't know what to expect. There is no standard. And Emma's saying there's the transparency obviously isn't there. That's the issue that we're working to change. And you had talked about, you know, change. And that brings me to my next question of you joining the Pilot Mental Health Campaign as a volunteer. So why do you think that it's important to congressionally push for air medical reform?
It's a kind of, well, in my personal life and having to explain to friends and family that I am no longer flying because I had a mental health crisis and reached out to the VA for help and went to therapy, that I am not allowed to fly an airplane. Everyone looked at me like I was insane. I'm just like, what do you mean you can't fly because you know, needed to get help for your own well-being? Like, people couldn't grasp that. So one, it's kind of seeing how few people really know how the air medical world works, and two, just kind of feeling I guess a bit affirmed by, you know, good friends around me that this was, you know, this is a very broken system. And you know, fortunately, the way it's structured, I kind of got run through the ringer with it. That, to me, I think just with more awareness, especially with anyone involved at the federal level, I think change would start to come with more awareness, both within the aviation community and outside of it, would hopefully make a really positive impact in the near future.
Yeah, for sure. And I can't say it enough. Thank you so much for joining us over at PMHC. Like, it, and if anyone is listening right now, if you have a similar story to Tony's, or if you or you know anyone who has been affected in this way and you want to, like, get involved and make some meaningful change, join us at PMHC. We're going to be back in DC in March, and we're really, really going to try and push for some impact, for some change, for some meaningful change. But Tony, again, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story. And first, thank you for even messaging us. I think a lot of people are still under that burden of stigma to the point where they're afraid to even reach out. So you know, for you to message me and then to be willing to come on the show and share your story. It is really impactful, and it touches a lot more people than, you know, it really helps break down that stigma. Together we like have to break the glass ceiling. So I appreciate you for being a part of that. But if our audience wants to connect with you, where can they do that?
So the easiest way to probably get a hold of me is going to be social media on Instagram. It's going to be the username is bad_Tony, T-O-N-Y-Y. You might also find my music page on there, which I'll still be able to reply to. Or if you're just curious, you can also find me on Spotify under the name Bad Tony as well. So those are all really quick, easy ways to kind of get a hold of me.
Awesome. Well, again, thank you so much for coming on. I know we're about to roll into our fun questions, but I wanted to ask you something that's kind of unrelated. You said that you lived in North Carolina for a little while after you moved away from Hawaii. Were you in Elizabeth City?
I sure was.
Oh my God. I grew up in Edenton.
Oh, no way.
Yes. I grew up in Chowan County. The Elizabeth City were my stomping grounds. That's where you went to do anything fun. The Walmart was there. They've got the TJ Maxx now, which of course that happened right before I moved away. But yeah, Elizabeth City. I knew when you said North Carolina, I was like, I guarantee fucking tea.
Oh yeah.
Well, it's not very often that I get to talk to people who even know where I'm from. I started my training out of Currituck and then went to Raleigh, but Yeah. Coast Guard's a big thing there where I'm from. Like half of everyone is a Coastie. My brother and sisters went to school with like a bunch of Coastie families. So yeah. Okay, cool.
And now you're in Washington, which
I know, isn't that weird?
With a lot of different, a lot of jumps in between from Utah, Oregon, and to Washington now. So I've lived all over the place at this point.
Yeah, that's awesome. I've lived in Utah myself too. I lived in Salt Lake City for a little bit, but it's cool because I saw you're in the Wenatchee area and I was like, oh snap, you're like, I used to work at the Wenatchee Airport. So.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. Pretty wild.
Very, very small world.
Very. Okay. So I'm going to jump into our fun question since we just reminisced about where we live and all that. So, this is all snowboard ski related because I know you worked at the ski area. So where do you think is like the best place to snowboard or ski?
At this point, after, you know, working from one of the biggest ski areas in the country to now being at a nice kind of quiet out of the way mom and pop here at Mission Ridge and Wenatchee, this might be little bit woo of me to say, but I don't think there is the best place. I don't think there's anywhere that's truly the best place to be for skiing if you're either by yourself or small group of friends and you're just having a good time with those people or out in nature. I don't think it matters that much. I've skied some of the deepest powder in the world, especially after last year, back when I was living at Alta and working there. And, this season, we're, kind of the Northwest has really had a rough go and there's been a lot of rain, a lot of warm temps and not that much snow, but I'm still finding that I'm having just as good of a time, just in slightly different circumstances.
Well, I love your answer because a lot of people that are hardcore skiers, I feel like they get super territorial, I guess would be the word. Like they ride hard for one place. And if you like another place, it's like a direct offense to them. So I was really curious to see how you would answer that, but you're actually like a cool skier. You're laid back. You're one of the real ones.
I am now. I will say that living and working at Alta is by proxy almost a cult because that kind of mentality really is prevalent there and any major ski resort in Utah or Colorado, it seems like. It's a lot of a need to rep home turf, but as far as I'm concerned, if it's pretty outside and I've got snow to ski and I feel good about the end of the day, it's all good to me.
Is there a snow at Mission right now?
But we've actually got most of the mountain open right now, which has been awesome. Like, we've somehow kind of gotten stuff open more consistently than a lot of other resorts in the Northwest. So I wish I was skiing it right now. I actually got injured when I was doing an avalanche course in Salt Lake the other week. So
I've
been sitting around at home with some torn cartilage in one or both of my kneecaps for a couple weeks now.
Yikes.
But hopefully be back with it in another week or two. So
yeah, I hope so. That, yeah. The knees are never good. So this is why, honestly, I never became like a snowboarder skier. I was a basketball player. That's what took me to Utah. I played basketball in college there, but I never was allowed to do snow sports because our coaches were like, you guys are going to hurt your knees if you do that. So we never did. And I, you know, I tore my ACL in basketball and my meniscus. So, I mean, it happened anyways, but that's how I never got into like snow sports, but I also kind of hate the cold. So that doesn't help. But I do love our snowboarding regions and skiing regions, because I love Stevens Pass too. I don't know if you ever work there, but I just think that area is so beautiful. And I've taken so many pictures for Emma. I'm like, you gotta come here just for skiing. Because Emma said she's got mountains in North Carolina, but I'm like, they're not the mountains of Washington.
They're still mountains.
Appalachia's beautiful. Like, I was just out in West Virginia a couple months ago, and I kind of forgot how nice it was to kind of be back in those good old mountains back east. But yeah, there's pros and cons to both. I mean, Devil's Backbone up in Virginia is an incredible spot. But being out here,
I absolutely love the Appalachians. Maddie hates on me all day long, but like, if I gotta be territorial, I love my mountains. they're not anything compared to what you get out west, but it still is so unique in its own right, and it's gorgeous up there. Like, what you were saying about there's no like better place to ski, I have such a humble answer because I grew up skiing in North Carolina. So I'm like, and it's been, I mean, I'm going this weekend and I'm so excited. We're going to Sugar Mountain. It's tiny, but like, I love it. It's a lot of fun and I always have a blast. And you know what? Learning how to ski on ice has taught me a thing or two. I feel like it's made me humble. So I definitely don't have like a favorite place to ski, but I love skiing in North Carolina. I've been to Breckenridge and Winter Park, and I loved Winter Park. Breckenridge was a little bit too big for me. So maybe that's where it comes from, is like growing up on those small ski slopes and small resorts. But yeah, I absolutely love skiing North Carolina. I don't care what anyone says. Give me the ice and the grass and the rocks.
Yeah, everyone that I've met over the years, working wise, the people that I've seen with the most heart and I guess most willingness to ski, you know, the most dog shit snow conditions, it's always folks from the East Coast and in the Midwest. Like, they're out, they're skiing it, and they're usually skiing it really well. You know, I guess kind of as far as giving kudos East and West side, I think East Coast kind of area as far as rivers, because I also raft guide in the summer as well, hard to beat a lot of the rivers out east compared to the West Coast as well. Like Gali, Penobscot, there's just so much going on in the rafting world as well. And skiing and rafting is kind of a yin yang thing for me, of, you know, just kind of playing in the water, whether it be frozen or not. So there's stuff to love no matter where you go or what season it is.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I've only river rafted once, and that was the Snoqualmie.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really cool. Like, I just got lucky, like got contacted by Beat Cakes of all brands, and they were like, you want to come on a river rafting, like river canoeing? I'm like, hell yeah, like I would love to do that. And they paid for the whole thing, and it was actually quite cool. I've never I tipped the canoe like twice, and I got to bring my husband with me because they're like, you can bring a guest if you'd like. But what an experience. I was like, I would love to do this again. I love anything like with adrenaline rushes. But I definitely should try out skiing or snowboarding. I know Emma would love that if I got into it. I think my biggest worry is like re-injuring my knee. But other than that, I feel like it'd be a great adrenaline rush.
Well, you'd probably like rafting a lot, because I mean, I didn't get into it until this past summer, but it's the same thing as flying. Like, if you think about the PHAC and kind of learning about track, and it's, you know, that image of a boat crossing a river, And it's easier because you can actually see the fluid now, and it's a 2D plane instead of a 3D plane of motion. So reading water comes, I think will come very easily to any pilot. And it's just a good time playing outside on the water too.
Oh, for sure. I didn't even think about
to a water baby right there. Maddie's all about some water. That's my little water baby.
That's what happens when you grow up on a lake. I mean, Emma, you grew up on a lake too. So we both are like anything with water, we're happy. But we're going to move on from this best place to snowboard, ski / raft and all that, and go into your favorite mountain range in the United States.
Favorite mountain range. That's hard. I do miss a lot of the red rocks down in down around Moab, as far as like beauty out there. Nevada is probably one of my favorite states ever, because it is the most mountainous state in the contiguous US. So gotta give the Ruby Mountain Range big props there. There's lots of hot springs out there. I suppose to a degree, I still have really strong feelings about the Wasatch back in Utah. I mean, there's a gorgeous front, just world-class skiing in the resort and in the backcountry. It's just kind of been squeezed to death pretty hard. And there's kind of the unofficial nickname now of calling it Los Angeles because of how busy it is. I think that holds. It's fairly accurate after being back there this past week for training, after living in a kind of Southeast Cascades where it's, you know, a lot more remote and low key.
Yeah. I think that's so funny. Los Angeles. I'm going to start calling it that. I will say, just living there, the Wasatch Front is amazing. Like, it's just right there in front of your face all the time. And living there was, I feel lucky that I got to see that every day. It's just, it is a gorgeous place in Utah, and there's so much to see there. I thought Washington had a lot, and then I went to Utah. I was like, wow, they got a lot going on with the red rocks and the transition from the northern part of the state to the southern part of the state. It's just very different. I think my favorite mountain range is going to be the Cascades because I grew up here. I love it. I've driven through all the passes, and I don't think it'll change. I've been to all 50 states. I haven't obviously driven through all the mountain ranges, but there's just something very special about the Cascade Mountains that I love.
Go for it.
I was just saying, I'm really looking forward to getting to actually see and get to know the Cascades once the days get a little bit longer and have a little bit more time from work to get outside of the resort to get into the backcountry around here, because mountains are gorgeous and I can see a lot of the Cascades from Mission. It's just don't have the time or means to go poking around out there right now.
Yeah.
I like, y'all's answers are so cool. I'm like, I'm just gonna go like Appalachians again, because like wherever Maddie took me in Washington was absolutely gorgeous. I've driven all through Colorado in the Rockies, and I absolutely loved all of those mountains. I don't know like the specific ranges, but it doesn't take a lot to please me, to be honest.
Yeah, I do love this about Emma. It's very easy to impress her. And that was like my whole goal when she visited Washington. I was like, I want to impress the shit out of Emma. I'm going to show her all the coolest places in Washington. And luckily she came during summer. It was during your birthday. So it was August, or end of July, beginning of August. So it was like the perfect time in Washington. And I took you to the place where I took Emma was Artist Point. So she went to Mount Baker, which is like one of the most gorgeous areas to go to look at Baker. And it's easy to walk around. You don't have to hike anywhere, but it is the spot where you go and launch off into big hikes. So yeah, that's where I took her.
This would be an off the podcast question, but early August birthday, that's same as mine.
When is your birthday?
August 4th.
Ooh. Oh my God. I'm July 30th.
Oh, okay.
But you're a Leo.
Yes, we love a Leo.
We'll leave, we have to leave this in because we're big astrology people. Like it's, that's our woo-woo thing that people are probably like, please, you're discrediting yourself. But again, what is it with me today? I'm like, give me a moon and a star and I'll believe anything.
We are really into astrology though. It's funny because typically in our pre-pod, I'll be like, I'm thinking this is your sign. And then the person will be like, you're right. So there is like energies there that I totally believe in. Em and I are all about it, but you can call us crazy if you want.
I've seen and heard actual crazy, and astrology is incredibly tame to some of the stuff that I've seen people talk about.
Yeah, I mean, hey, if the moon can make the ocean turn, I'm like, hey, it must be making me feel some type of way. I feel like it's not too crazy, but it's the people that live their life completely around it that I'm like, all right, now that's a little bit too far. You got to take it for what it is. It's like an affirmation kind of.
Yeah. Yeah.
But all right, I'll ask the last question and I know what you're going to say. I feel like I know what you're going to say. Skiing, snowboarding, or I love Maddie, sledding.
Well, I mean, this is going to be very biased because I've always been a skier, and the learning curve of that alone was enough. I don't need to start hucking my body down the mountain like a rag doll because I want to learn how to do it sideways on a snowboard. And for sledding, if I had a ton of disposable money to spend on parts that are going to break every other month, seems like it would be awesome. Like I've always kind of bitch and complain about seeing sleds in the backcountry when I'm having to, you know, walk a couple miles to get where I want to ski and people are zooming around on sleds. But if I had one, I would be super stoked.
And skiing since I cannot even remember when my dad taught me how to ski. I think I was like 5 years old. I was so little. I'll never forget it. But when you've grown up doing it, it's hard to like switch gears. So I'm definitely choosing skiing. And I'll again agree with you. If I had like if I had the ability to sled, I would be sledding.
I'm what about sledding, you, guys.
He's like, get me on that motorized vehicle.
Yeah, we were talking about sledding. I was like, that's, I pick that, please. No, I just, like I said, I'm not a huge snow person, and I think I blame me being an athlete and why I don't. I will be down in the lodge watching you guys ski / maybe snowboard. And if I am going to go on the top of the mountain, I'm going to take a sled up there. So.
Well, this was such a fun conversation. Again, Tony, thank you so much for joining us and for joining us as well at PMHC. If anyone out there is listening right now and you have a free second, please sign up and join PMHC. And if you have the ability to do so, please donate. It helps us attend and do all the things that we are planning on doing this year. We're planning on trying to attend an aviation event and speak or hold some kind of forum, at least attempting to every single month this year, as well as our DC fly-ins. And we do need donations for that. All of this does cost money, unfortunately. So if you have the ability to do so, please head over to pmhc.org and sign up there. And if you do have the time, rate and review the show 5 stars, because why would you do anything less? It helps us connect with people like Tony and have these meaningful conversations. So if you can do that as well. But that is it for this week's episode. Thank you all so much for tuning in and listening. As always, keep the blue side up and the brown side down. We'll see y'all next week.